Rewind is a production of Wisconsin Eye. To keep programs like this free and accessible to all, please consider a charitable gift to wiseye.org/donate or text WISEYE to 44321.
Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This program is brought to you from Wisconsin Eye's Margaret Farrow Studio.
This week on Rewind, your week in review, liberals will maintain their majority on the state Supreme Court after Susan Crawford cruised to victory Tuesday night. Plus, the political headwinds facing President Trump and Republicans after a hard-fought election and major rebuke to their agenda. And justices hear oral arguments on cases challenging lame duck laws and funding a reading program. All that and more on Rewind, your week in review for April 4th.
Hi, I'm Emily Fannin.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
Well, it's Friday, TGIF, yes. Another election, one for the record books, is over. The state Supreme Court contest, of course, sucked up all the attention, national attention that it received, and the liberal candidate, Susan Crawford, easily cruised to victory on Tuesday night when the race was called shortly, about 45 minutes after polls closed. As you can see, Crawford, these are unofficial results, but what we have so far, roughly about 99% proceedings in, Crawford with a 10-point lead over her conservative opponent, Brad Schimmel. Before we get into turnout and what factors led to her 10-point victory, let's first hear from her victory speech and Schimmel conceding on Tuesday night.
Today, Wisconsinites fended off an unprecedented attack on our democracy. That's right. Our fair elections and our Supreme Court. And Wisconsins stood up and said loudly that justice does not have a price. Our courts are not for sale.
I've called Judge Crawford and conceded. No. You got to accept the results. The numbers aren't gonna turn around. They're too bad, and we're not gonna pull this off. So, thank you guys from the bottom of my heart. God bless you. God bless the state of Wisconsin. God bless America. We will rise again. We'll get up to fight another day. But this wasn't our day.
Now, there was also very high turnout on Tuesday as well. Over 2.3 million voters here in Wisconsin cast ballots, which, again, is another record on top of the record spending that we saw in this contest. That's roughly turnout is about 26% higher compared to the 2023 spring election, of course, when control of the court was also up for grabs. But let's talk about some of the takeaways from the Crawford and Schimmel contest. Of course, there's the Elon Musk factor. Let's begin with that, because many conservatives and Republicans that I talked to this week believe he was someone of a double-edged sword, right? They don't think without his money, it could have been maybe an even 15-point defeat compared to Crawford. But on the other hand, they do think it really hurt his campaign. But how do you, as Brad Schimmel, you know, go around and campaign across the state without the support from President Trump and Elon Musk? It's kind of that double-edged sword, like I was mentioning.
So the national take on Wisconsin's race has been that this is a referendum on Musk and Trump. And I get why the national folks are saying that, but I think they're missing some key factors in talking to people this week. The first one is Wisconsin's spring electorate is now a plus five, roughly, Democratic electorate. Like, they start with an advantage every spring of about 5 points. Then, if you go back on history, if you add fuel to that fire, you get a 10-point victory. So here you had really is the Trump administration plus Elon Musk inserting himself in unique ways in this race. 2023, referendum on abortion and redistricting. You know, Janet Prosecutor ran on her values when it comes to abortion and also on rigged maps. 2020, you had an active Democratic primary for president going on. Republican one wasn't going on because Trump was the incumbent. That helped produce a double-digit win. 2018, Rebecca Dallet, you had the real kind of referendum on Trump, and a sign of the blue wave that was coming that fall. The one example is, except for 2019, in the candidate, you're Lisa Neubauer, try to run a nonpartisan race. You want to be like the old school Supreme Court race of, here are my supporters, my endorsements, my credentials, that should be enough. What I'm getting at is, it's not all about Trump and Musk. They were a factor, especially with Musk like giving out our checks at the end, campaigning in Green Bay. You can't ignore that. But there's a structural advantage for Democrats, and they just did a better job of how they spent their money. Susan Crawford, so looking at the transfers from the state parties. So 2 years ago, Percy Bush got like $10 million, which was a ton of money. Kelly wouldn't take any, Daniel Kelly, and that was a big deal. This year, I tracked $11.4 million transfer from the Democratic Party to Crawford, $9.5 million from the state GOP to Schimmel. So it wasn't like they weren't playing, they were playing an uneven hand, but Crawford raised so much money from individuals. We talked about this before, but in a 6 week period, she raised $10.5 million from individual donors, that's up to $20,000 a person. That's a clip of $251,000 per day for six solid weeks. I've never seen that before. Nobody have talked to a senator. I mean, governor's races, Senate races, nothing like that before. Then you had the way it was spent. So Crawford took the money from the party, individual donations, and she was up on the air in a way that, yes, you had Schimmel, you had WFC, it's Issues Mobilization Council, you had Musk PAC, you had Dick Uline's Fair Courts America. They're all running ads. The main driver of ads on the Democratic side, liberal side, was Susan Crawford, about $25 million. That allowed her to basically match or exceed the gross ratings points that the other guys were putting together. They just spent it more efficiently, and the Republican conservative side continues. They got smarter this time, people tell me.
Yeah.
We saw money go to the state party, $3 million from Elon Musk, money to Schimmel. But they still have their little turfs, right? So WMC, there's a reason for that. Their donors don't want their names on a campaign finance report out in public. They're business owners. They want to keep it on the down low. They support these candidates, but they don't want to broadcast out there, hurt their business. So that's why you give to WMC for this Issues Mobilization Council. Dick Uline, that's just how Dick does things. I mean, people will tell you he has this group, Fair Courts America. He likes to do his own messaging. They all have their little fiefdom, right? This side's more organized, more unified, more cooperative. Now, you can't coordinate candidate and groups in terms of the ad stuff, right? What I'm talking about is you have this coalition of groups, both sides. The Democrats do a better job in how they coordinate. The candidate does a better job in how he or she spends the money. And you have an electorate that's favorable toward you. That gives you a victory. So it's not just Trump and Musk. They are important factors, but that all adds up to 10 points in
Crawford's
favor.
Right, and talking about the advantage that Crawford had on TV, also many predict that Schimmel was defined very early in this race,
yes,
and he didn't have the financial bliss of Elon Musk money until late January, and Crawford was already up on ads. So he didn't have much of a response right away to many things like the abortion issue, the rape test kit backlog when he was attorney general years ago. Also, I think you can't ignore the polling and the warning signs that we saw ahead of Tuesday, especially about Elon Musk. He had a 60% disapproval rate, a poll that came out the day after the election that was a national poll by Marquette University. There was also many other polls that were out there that showed that people didn't really like Musk and what he's been doing in the federal government, these sweeping cuts, mass layoffs. He wasn't a very popular figure. So is that the big energy factor beyond abortion, Act 10, all these other issues that the liberal candidate tried to make part of her campaign, even if she wasn't talking about these issues? Also, the money, I think, was a factor defining early on. But also, let's get to the other takeaways, which is looking at the math and statistics comparing how the candidates performed in certain areas, because it's always about a numbers game, right? You and I and many other people start watching the map on election night, and once we see these early returns in certain areas, I mean, Milwaukee was still counting ballots, and I was telling my newsroom, it's not going to matter. Milwaukee doesn't matter because of how she performed in, of course, Democratic strongholds, but other parts of the state. And specifically for Schimmel, it was Waukesha. He needed to get to that 60%. He didn't get there. So let's first just talk about Crawford's performance in Dane and Milwaukee. As you can see, her goal was to exceed Janet Protasiewicz's numbers. Well, she did that just barely, but she made inroads in many other parts of the state. She won the Bow counties, you know, things like that. And like I said, Milwaukee was still counting ballots. They also had seven polling sites run out of ballots. So that was all going on. That's where the tension, it seemed like it was on election night, but it ultimately didn't matter.
So, you know, Dane County is a turnout machine for Democrats. That's the bottom line. You get, you know, Crawford and Pro Se, which same ballpark. Milwaukee, percentage-wise, same ballpark. But what's interesting about Milwaukee was 2 years ago, Dane County cast more ballots in the Supreme Court race than Milwaukee County did. Mm-hmm. That didn't happen this time. Milwaukee County was Milwaukee again for the liberal side of the aisle. That was what's impressive about Milwaukee did. In the wild counties, talk about the Trump effect. You're seeing a continued erosion. Now, look at the numbers, you know, the wild counties, they're really in the same ballpark for Kelly and Schimmel. If you start rounding, like, out the decimal points, you see a little bit more erosion. That's the Trump effect. And to your point about messaging, great point about crime. People talk about Trump and Musk and everything else. Number one thing we saw in ads, crime. Crime, 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 crime. The sentence that you gave out to child molesters, predators, those kinds of things. Crawford did a great job of neutralizing that issue. I mean, Republicans sort of have a natural advantage on crime in any race. Mm-hmm. But she fought him to a draw on that. Then beyond that, she had abortion and corruption. These other things. What did he have? Trump. I looked at the top 10 ads that ran the final week of the race. Number one ad, by terms of viewings, was Schimmel's ad about Trump's endorsement. Number 10 was his 15-second version of the Trump endorsement ad. So he went all in.
And that was very late, too. That was the past 2 weeks before the election?
Mm-hmm. But he went all in on Trump because he had to. He needed the Trump supporters to come out. Remember, Schimmel said over and over again, if I get 60% of Trump's backers, I'll win. He got 62%. What happened was she got 78% of Harris's supporters. What's interesting is we talk about early vote like all the time. We all look at the numbers. All of us reporters do. What's this mean? It meant that turnout was up everywhere. But for Republicans, they cannibalized their election day turnout. You saw some numbers that were up. But Washington County, for example, early vote doubled compared to 2 years ago. In raw numbers overall, it was up, you know, like 12-14%, but it wasn't up huge. Whereas Democratic areas, they had their regular voters, the people turn out every April. They also brought in new voters. That's why it was up so much higher on their side of the aisle in this election. So my caution going forward is, I'm a dork out election, an early vote, you know, going forward, look at where it's at. You can't really look at that number unless you know who was voting. Is it new voters or traditional voters? But for Republicans, they're happy they're embracing the early vote. But if you're just taking your election day voters and making them like the week before voters, that's not helping. You've got to turn out more people.
Well, there were so many people that did door knocking either under these Musk super PACs or just from the Republican Party. And we talked to a lot of them at the Schimmel campaign on election night after the results were called. They were so shocked because they thought the momentum was on their side looking at those early voting numbers. We talk about this on the show. I was telling our viewers in Milwaukee the same thing. You got to be cautious about that because we don't know who these people are voting early. I think there's also a lot of people on both sides of the aisle just like doing it because things can happen on election day, right? I mean, there's been tons of legal battles over absentee ballot drop boxes, you know, conspiracy theories out there, you know. It's still going to be out there, but I think most people just like to get it done with. They want to get it over with. Also, there's this, sometimes if you vote early, you'll stop getting the text messages and the reminders. Sometimes that works. But, I think that is also just a new trend that we could be seeing. So that's why we just urge people caution about that.
And what's the big takeaway about turnout here versus November? Trump voters only turn out when Trump is on the ballot. If you are a Republican, if you can get that 3.4 million turnout like you had in November, you can win Wisconsin statewide. But if you can't get the Trump voter engaged and off your elections, you're going to struggle.
Besides Ron Johnson, he's the other unicorn in this, right? Yeah. He won a 2022 reelection. Also, just want to quickly touch on Republicans' possible political headwinds, right? I mean, there's a lot of questions about Brian Schimming and his leadership going forward. Not my questions. I mean, these are what you're hearing from Republican inner circles because they thought they had built such a successful ground game in November with Turning Point Action, all the, you know, trying to drive out the young conservative vote. Well, where were they in April? Obviously, they don't often vote in low turnout, non-presidential years. But that is also something that they got to, you know, look into is that you thought you had a winning strategy. But when it comes to spring elections, it's just a different beast overall. Yeah. All right. Now, let's just quickly remind people that Yes, as we just got done with one election, state Supreme Court one, well, there's going to be one for the next several years, and that's starting in 2026. Rebecca Bradley's term ends. Then 2027, you have Annette Ziegler, the Chief Justice. Then you got Rebecca Dallet, a liberal justice. I mean, it goes on and on, as you can see on this timeline. But what this overall is what we're trying to tell people is that liberals cemented their liberal majority at least for the next 3 years.
So the question for 2026 is, if you are a conservative, do you invest in Wisconsin? You're not going to win back the majority. So how do you get people engaged? For liberals, that's almost a luxury. You got back-to-back luxuries. You don't need the Bradley or Ziegler seat to have the majority. But if you pick one off, you make Dallet's race no big deal because you have a buffer, essentially. So it'll be interesting to watch the spending next year. It's up to $109 million as of this morning spent in this race. I don't think we're going to hit that next down. I don't make predictions, but it'd be hard to see him spend that much money on races not for the majority a
right.
year from now.
It's not as much higher stakes. All right, now we got to cover the other statewide issue on the ballot, of course. That was the Department of Public Instruction. The incumbent, Dr. Jill Underley, did come out on top over her opponent, Brittany Kinzer. That was 53% to 47%. Again, let's just take a listen to some of the candidates after election night.
To the educators who dedicate their lives to teaching, to the parents who support and advocate for their children, and to the students who inspire us daily with their resilience and curiosity, this victory is for you. So let's move forward with renewed dedication and unity, ensuring that Wisconsin remains a leader in public education. Thank you for your trust, your support, and your unwavering belief in the promise of our public schools.
I just want to say that it didn't turn out the way we hoped, but I hope more people get involved and make sure that our children are learning how to read and that they are prepared for the future, because children are depending on us. So I want to say thank you all so much. This is just one race. This is my life's calling, is to work for our children, and I won't stop today. So I hope you all don't either.
What I think was most interesting, seeing the results here compared to the top of the both their top of the ticket to the state Supreme Court race, is that Underley got about 200,000 votes less than Crawford. So once again, we have this weird formula in Wisconsin where either voters are skipping that or, you know, split-ticking their results, voting for Crawford, voting for Kinzer. But that was one of the main takeaways that I saw as the results were called.
So Underley took this tact of, I'm trying not to make it about me. I want it to be about the challenger. And if we talked before, did a lot of public forums. One online forum that I saw turned down a request from us, WISN, Milwaukee Press Club, others to do, like, you know, events in front of an audience. Basically realized that, hey, she's got some baggage. The revamp of the benchmarks for standardized testing, the not telling Milwaukee voters about the issues of Milwaukee public schools reporting on financial situations ahead of a $252 million referendum a year ago. Those are not great things, but if you make that about the challenger, not the incumbent, it gives you a better shot. And then two, you hit your wagon to the top of the ticket. So Crawford winning by 10 points helped a whole lot. Now, if Crawford had won by 4 or 5, that might have made that strategy not a very good one. But Underley wins, and conservatives who put all their hopes and dreams into Brittany Kinzer, spent a lot of money on her behalf, once again lose a DPI race. I have yet to see the establishment education establishment pick not win that race. It wasn't double digits, which it was most of the time. It was single digits, but do you invest in that going forward? Like, and also now you're left with a incumbent who is actually opposed, not just expanding school choice, but the program in general. She wants to kill school choice. So how do you operate in that environment with Jill Underley's state for the next 4 years?
All right. The one victory that Republicans really do like is the ballot measure, of course, that passed that will enshrine the state's voter ID law into the state constitution. For most voters, for most people, nothing's going to change. You're still going to have to show your photo ID. But this has really been a tactic and a strategy for Republicans who do fear, now that the court's majority is maintained 4-3, they could possibly see another challenge to the voter ID law. But now this makes it much more difficult to make that challenge or to strike it down in the courts. All right, let's move on to oral arguments that were also a busy week here at the Capitol. One case that we want to highlight, of course, is Josh Call's challenge to the state legislature that would determine whether those lame duck laws laws that were passed in 2018 before he was sworn into office would require approval from lawmakers on certain civil settlements. He's arguing that violates the separation of powers between the executive and legislative branches. Then yesterday, we had another case that will decide if Governor Tony Evers properly used his veto pen authority on a reading bill and whether GOP lawmakers have the power to continue to withhold $50 million to fund that program.
So the first one, really inside baseball. Second one is inside baseball, but has an impact on the budget. What I mean by that is it's clear governors can use a partial veto authority on a spending bill. Like, the budget is a spending bill. There's no question about that. What's been happening, though, is Republicans have been more and more putting money into the Joint Finance Committee's supplemental appropriation and saying to agencies, you can have that money once you come back and ask us for us. And two, doing trailer bills that have policy outside the budget because the governor can rework anything in a spending bill. They want these trailer bills that have the policy part. This Dane County judge basically said, hey, I'm taking these three bills in the reading package and reading them as one. There was funding in the budget bill. There was the policy in one bill. And then there was a third bill that set up the structure of how to spend the money, the two appropriations. Not a single dollar in it, though. The governor reworked a third bill without a single dollar in it and said, hey, that's an appropriation bill because it directs how the money should be spent. During the oral arguments, DOJ, Department of Justice, argued that you have to look at both money coming in and money going out. Look at it as one. There was some skepticism about that argument. But if the court rules that the governor was okay and know what he did, that then impacts those trailer bills. That's something to keep in mind with this budget, because we're already looking at reasons why lawmakers could slow things down. This could be one of them.
Right, because there's maybe some rumors going on. Is the state budget going to be delayed, right? I mean, JR, you've been to plenty more budget cycles than I have. It's always a big talk, but there are a lot of different factors this time around than years past, largely due to what the Trump administration is doing with federal cuts and job cuts, what it could mean for Wisconsin. We know almost every action that the Trump administration has taken, either through executive order or through DOGE, has been challenged by Wisconsin's Attorney General, Josh Call. He's joined many attorneys generals in these lawsuits. But now that they're out here having these budget hearings and public forums, it's really kind of coming to a head. And you asked the co-chairs this week about, well, what's going on? So what they basically said is that there could be a number of factors that could impact the committee and when it will wrap up its work on the 2025-2027 state budget. So Representative Mark Bourne and Senator Howard Markline said it's almost premature to try and speculate whether those factors will push to completion of the document past the end of the fiscal year, which is on June 30th.
Yeah. And so just real quick, look, there's all kinds that could happen. They stressed we're on time right now. And the Legislative Fiscal Bureau will have like revised fiscal or estimates about mid-May. They're going to wait for that to really dive into the big stuff in the budget, which is what happens all the time. You know, your corrections, UW, taxes, that stuff. Although it is April now. I got a feeling we might see a tax bill like April 15th-ish from Republicans trying to send a message about what they want to do when it comes to taxes.
I can bet that too. All right, let's get to stock picks this week. And rising is Justice Jill Karofsky, who got, or will I should say, have a new title in 2 months.
Yeah, so the Chief Justice is an elected position now. Way back when, for a long time, it was the most senior member of the court. And Shirley Abramson had that title for years and years and years. But once the amendment was passed to give the court the authority to elect somebody, conservatives moved her out and picked Pat Rogensack. Then Annette Ziegler became Chief Justice. Well, this week they had a new election. Now it's going to be Ann Walsh Bradley for 2 months, which is kind of like a retirement gift, because mm-hmm. Ann Walsh is retiring for 30 years on the bench, Chief Justice for 2 months, the 29th Chief Justice in Wisconsin history. Then Karofsky takes over after that 2 month stint and will fill out the rest of the 2 year term, the 30th Chief Justice in Wisconsin history. Now, ever since liberals flipped this court, there's been a talk about, okay, who's going to be the next chief, right? And once Ann Walsh said, I'm going to retire, became Rebecca Dallet and Jill Karofsky. Those are the two contenders for this job. Well, in talking to people, they pointed out to me that Dallet's race is going to be in 2028. You can't predict the future. Will it be for the majority again? We don't know. But if she were to become chief, she'd be chief through spring of 27. She's going to have to start gearing up for that election well ahead of like 2028. So you free her up to focus on her reelection in 2028 and do more of the decision, like writing decisions and stuff. Karofsky on up until 2030. It makes sense logistically to do that. By the way, for some people who watch the court for a long time, the fact that conservatives took the title away from Shirley Abramson when they could and now they're giving it to Ann Walsh Bradley, for the liberals, for 2 months. Kind of poetic justice, because Ann Walsh is a huge ally of Shirley Abramson for many, many years in that court.
All right, let's get to Mix this week. And we're looking at a possible, or the rumors about a challenge to the congressional maps after, of course, we know this is a key issue in the state Supreme Court race. And, of course, we see top Democrats nationwide talking about, hey, this could be a pathway if Crawford wins, which she did, possibly flipping two congressional seats. And that's why you see the two Republicans on your screen, which is Derek Van Orden and Brian Stile, because we're talking about their districts. But, JR, you kind of have some doubts that this could maybe happen.
It's not as easy as they want to make you think it is. So, look, there was a gift to Republicans in this race where Susan Crawford's on a fundraising call. The subject line was basically putting two House seats in play. The implication was, hey, if we win, there could be a challenge to the congressional map. It's now 6-2 Republican. You could put the third, which Van Orden represents, and the first, where Stile is, in play. Redraw those lines. It's not that simple. Okay, so let's do a little history lesson and kind of like talk legalese for a second. Number one, the state Supreme Court in 2022, threw out the old legislative maps, right? They're actually put in place by the court in 22 in the conservative majority. 23, there was a lawsuit filed once Janet Prosewich became justice. The court said there's a constitutional problem with those maps. They have non-contiguous territory, like basically these islands of municipalities that aren't in the same district. That's a problem. They did not address partisanship. That was not what they did for saying this map's not cool. Now, they did talk about, hey, when you submit new maps, keep that in mind. After the court threw out that map, which is based on a least change approach, in 2021, there was no agreement between Tony Evers and Republican lawmakers how to draw a new map. The court, the old conservative majority, said, okay, when you submit maps, you should have a least change approach to your proposals. They all drew maps, least change approach. In 2023, the court said that principle doesn't work anymore. We're not dealing with that. There was a challenge filed a congressional map saying, if you no longer have least change approach, you should then throw out the congressional map because that principle doesn't exist anymore. The court said no, unanimously. So number one, if you're gonna file a challenge to congressional maps, you gotta find a way to flip at least three members of the court who were there before and get Susan Crawford to say, yeah, let's take up a challenge to congressional map. That's problem number one. Problem number two is, what's your argument going to be? Partisanship? Okay. This court didn't take up partisanship in the legislative map case, right? They talked about other things. Number two, the history lesson. This was not a partisan gerrymander. This was a incumbent protection act. So go back to 2011. Republicans win both houses of legislature. Scott Walker's governor. They draw new maps for legislature. The congressional maps are drawn by the aides to members of the congressional delegation. This is how it used to work back in the day. The senior staff, the senior members of the delegation got together and drew the map and said, here you go. What they did was they took Stevens Point out of the 7th and moved into the 3rd, like that kind of weird island that goes up and grabs the 3rd. That was to shore up Ron Kind, who was a congressman from the Western District before. And Sean Duffy, the Republican, who just won that seat, made his district less Democratic. They've been Democratic in Dave Obey's hands for years. Those guys drew the map and gave it to the Republicans. Lawmakers were like, hey, we can draw a map. It's really good for you guys. They said, no, here's your map. So it wasn't a partisan gerrymander. It was a protection act for incumbents. So that was a map drawn in 2011. Governor Evers took that least change approach, applied it to that old map from 2011. His map was picked. So you're going to argue that map was a partisan gerrymander? Okay.
It's going to be tough to sell.
You have to prove there's no alternative reason for why those lines were drawn, okay? So this is just pieces of the onion. There are all kinds of problems. Oh, and by the way, the court moved with incredible speed in the legislative maps a couple years ago. They got that case in August. They had a decision out by Christmas. That doesn't happen very often. And oh, by the way, if somehow the court did throw out this map, the congressional map, you could get the U.S. Supreme Court's attention, and they could come say, hey, wait a second,
not
guys.
So fast, yeah.
So people I talked to would bet you the 2026 map will be the same one we had in 2024. Doesn't mean that Van Orden shouldn't be worried. He only beat Cook by 2.7 points. If this spring is going to suggest things are going to happen next year, which I caution comparing April elections to November ones, could be a bad year for Republicans. Cook raised $1 million in 20 days. So he should still be worried, but not about really new lines.
And it's still a competitive district, no doubt. All right, let's get to Falling this week, and it's the Conservatives Coalition, which we talked a little bit earlier about, because now the track record is that they've lost 16 out of the past 19 statewide elections.
Now, you're going to tell me that they had the perfect ground game in November and they forgot to turn people out in April? I don't buy it. My point is that it's not just the ground game. It's message and messenger, right? Trump was the right messenger with the right message last fall. This spring, again, Democratic electorate plus five to start, these other factors, Schimmel's on a trajectory to lose, right, before Musk got involved, then it made it worse. So for Republicans now, it's a second, what do we do differently in spring races, right? Well, one thing one Republican told me was, we could try running a woman for once for Supreme
Court. I got told the same thing, yeah, because they do have a successful track seat. I mean, six out of the seven justices on the court are women.
They could try not running a man who lost before, because remember, Brad Schimmel lost his re-election for AG in 2018. Daniel Kelly lost his re-elect for Supreme Court in 2020. But you have to have the right message and messenger. They don't have that combination right now. And now what's happening is the finger pointing. State party convention in May should be a hoot to go to that, listen to the fallout from that one. Question about Brian Schimming and how they're running things, who's doing what. My conclusion is, with ground games, I never get a full story of them because you're not. I'm on the door to people every weekend seeing what they do. But Democrats, they're all at the same kind of like get-together saying, okay, I got this, you got that. The groups, not the candidate, but the groups. The Republicans don't coordinate as well as these guys do. They have their little fiefdom sometimes, just overlap other things. And that's a problem for them. So the question is, what do you do going forward? Now, max turnout, like November presidential years, that's good for Republicans. Low turnout, Dems are more motivated. What do you do? I don't predict anything about November 26th. Not at all, because who knows what's going to happen now and then. But for Republicans, this has got to be kind of like a kick in the gut. Like, what do we do differently? They weren't outspent. You know, I tracked $109 million, $9 million of the good for Brad Schimmel, the whole coalition.
I think the one thing you're missing is talking about the issues.
That was my next point.
All right. So, wrapping a bow on it.
Where was the transgender stuff? Yep. Where was the immigration stuff? Where was the economy stuff? Well, this is a judicial race.
I was just going to say there's different.
Take the economy off. Transgender, there was an ad from Schimmel the last week and a half or so of the race about that. There was another group that did some, but not a lot. Immigration, there's one annex. I'll try to shoehorn this into an immigration thing. The things that Trump voters care about weren't on the ballot Tuesday. They didn't have a reason to go out, and that was part of the problem. So again, turnout is awesome. It's great, engages people. Turnout gets you a victory when you're in a tie ball game. When you're down by a touchdown, it doesn't matter.
All right, another sports metaphor. Gotta love it. All right, that will do it for a very busy week. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Emily Fannin.
I'm J.R. Ross.
We'll see you next week.
This program was brought to you from the Margaret Farrell Studio.
Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.